Hey, what up? It's Airlift Mike here. So I get this call in April from Manhattan Producers in New York looking for help to record James Carville's new audiobook for Penguin Audio. It's destined for worldwide distribution through Amazon.com, stuff like that. And just ahead of the big political presidential election, you know what I mean? Big job! We'll phone patch. They'll coach James via Skype through his headphones. Carville shows up at Airlift April 23rd. In his shiny black Escalade with assistant Claire in tow, and we lay down the first of three long sessions for It's the Middle Class, Stupid. That's the book, right? So here's this icon, right? He's fodder for jokes and impersonations from Saturday Night Live to South Park. Put Bill Clinton in the White House twice, and now he's sitting at the Airlift Studios with me, right? As a lifelong political atheist, to use a colorful Carville colloquialism, I ain't got a dog in this hunt, but I got to admit, just as a fellow human being, James and I did find some common ground to connect on. I mean, really, when you get right down to it, we may have all come to these shores we call America in different ships, but we're all in the same boat now.
Perhaps the prevailing sentiment was that if blacks weren't so pushy, life would continue along as it had before. Few times in life you can pick out an experience that forced you to alter an opinion you held. I can right here. When I was 16, I borrowed a copy to Kill a Mockingbird from the mobile library. I asked for a book about football, but I guess the lady could tell I needed some educating. I got so engrossed in Harper Lee's classic that I stuck it inside a different cover and read it under my desk during lessons at school. When I finished, I realized I was wrong about race, dead wrong, and I could see which side was going to represent me. I understood from reading To Kill a Mockingbird that things had to change, and I knew the federal government had to make these changes. I developed a fascination for the machinery of politics from the theater and circus I saw at the state legislature in Baton Rouge during the 50s. I had a summer job running checks around town for a local bank, and it was great to get a sign delivered to the Louisiana legislature. I'd watched a session for a few minutes in the gallery, and one time I saw Governor Earl Long marching down the halls, trailing cops and reporters and functionaries behind him like he was the most important man in the world. It was the coolest thing I'd seen in my life. To this day, Earl Long remains one of my great political heroes. Earl was governor three times, elected in 39, 48, and 56, and the last of these terms coincided with my teenage years, and my rebellious streak liked his iconoclasm. In Louisiana, you were either one of two camps on Earl and his brother Huey, who died in 1935. And while my family was anti, I appreciated his sense of humor and his cleverness. Earl's every instinct was populist, and he distrusted corporate power with every bone in his body, both of which opinions appealed to this young man. In 1959, Wallace Shawn, the editor of the New Yorker, sent his great reporter, A.J. Liebling, down to Louisiana to write about Earl because the governor had been committed to a mental hospital. Among the issues politicians had with Earl was that he was insufficiently dogmatic on the question of segregation. Liebling came to Louisiana and, after about an hour, proclaimed that, in fact, the only sane person in the state was the governor and that everybody else was nuts. Before I started practicing law in Baton Rouge, I did a stint teaching eighth grade science at the school in Vashri, which completes my story through the law. Eventually, I started working on political campaigns and ended up where I am today. It never struck me at the time that I was earning an inferior living by working as a deckhand on a dredge boat that had a government contract. The beach we worked on, Florida, was public. Anybody could go to it. You could be poor, middle class, or rich, and I guess I should have realized it was nothing but a lot of shiftless people out there sitting on the beach. The state could have charged them a fee because they were sucking on one version of the government's sugar tit as we were building up a beach for the recreation on the government's dime. The work I did on the Mississippi River was more noble because we were making sure goods could move freely around the country. As I've grown older, I found out that it's just a little more complicated than that. In the world of right-wing television or talk radio, I was probably a more honorable person then, even if I was still middle class. How can you lie to people about income mobility and yet cut funding to the very thing that's going to provide them any hope for income mobility? Yet, that's what we do. The idea of cutting education is absurd. Stupidity costs money. Education doesn't cost money. Does anybody think the kids who are committing crimes in New Orleans are committing them because they're too educated? We see the same situation being played out across the country. Part of the denial of middle-class hardship is to downplay the effects of income inequality. Let's face it, it's tough to be rich. It's hardly worth the extra effort it takes to become super wealthy, given that poor people can get their grubby hands on pretty much everything billionaires have. The most asinine newspaper piece I've read in years was written by a guy named Andy Kessler in the Wall Street Journal. Thanks to what Mr. Kessler calls consumption equality, the wealthy work their 60 to 80-hour weeks inventing things for the masses. But there's not much that they can buy with their money that the middle class can't afford. What does Google founder Larry Page have that you don't have, Mr. Kessler asked, perhaps rhetorically? A suite to the Super Bowl? You're better off watching on TV. A Bugatti? Why even bother? Even a $16,500 Ford Focus can hit 80 on the highway or get stuck in the same traffic as a rich person's ride. On he goes. A hip replacement or a stent? You can only afford one because some rich person invented it for the masses, like they did smartphones, hard drives, and affordable air travel. It shouldn't come as a surprise that Mr. Kessler used to manage a hedge fund. What he spouts is a classic argument for the low taxes for us, low wages for you crowd. We should concur with Mr. Kessler and be grateful for what we have. So what if we're working years longer and our incomes are going down? We can buy that better TV and watch football. Who cares if we can't afford to send our kids to college? We can buy them a cell phone, now they don't cost $4,000, and talk to them as they stand in line for a job interview at McDonald's.